Okay, welcome everybody. I was asked to make a copy of this overhead, which I have done, and you've now got copies of it. And I've also given you a list of sort of astronomical words that may help with some of the jargon. Now, I thought, I've had a couple of requests to say something about vacuum energy or dark energy. And if I was giving a talk on cosmology, that would be one of the topics we would have to consider. But just to say very briefly that when Einstein originally formulated his differential equation to describe the nature of the universe, he put in a term to stop the universe collapsing, because he wasn't aware then that the universe actually had an initial condition that meant it was expanding. And that term, he then said, was his greatest mistake, and that term has been kind of reintroduced to represent the effects of this vacuum energy. So if you like, that's just a constant in an equation, and it doesn't tell us the nature of the beast. And the bottom line is, we don't know the nature of the beast. And if we accept it as just Einstein's term, as he put it in, as a constant in that differential equation, then the universe will indeed expand forever and tear itself, you know, until it becomes black and infinitely large, and even atoms are being torn apart. People like Neil Turok, who are string theorists, suggest that this vacuum energy is something that can emerge from their own theory, and indeed it does emerge in quantum theory, where the idea of the vacuum is that the vacuum is never empty, it is seething with virtual particles that come in and out of existence. And apparently, beyond my abilities, a simple calculation in quantum theory shows that the expected energy of the vacuum is about 10 to the power of 100 times greater than the observed value. So in a sense, it's not unexpected that there is this force that results from an apparent vacuum that is this seething mass of virtual particles coming in and out of existence. So Neil Turok has somewhat arbitrarily, some other string theorists consider, invented a potential that describes the variation of the vacuum energy with time, and describes a very important idea that is fundamental to cosmology, the idea of inflation. Inflation was introduced quite without knowledge of any of these things. And that is that at a very early stage in the universe's history, it suddenly inflated by an enormous factor, maybe 10 to the power of 30 or something, and from its initial state. And it was that inflation that ensured that everywhere we look in the universe today seems to be in perfect thermodynamic equilibrium, even though there has not been time since this moment for those two places to communicate with each other from one side of the universe to the other to bring them into thermodynamic equilibrium. So that equilibrium must have been established here and then inflated at an enormous rate at this very early time so that it now appears in equilibrium today. So Neil Turok says, well, his potential will describe this inflation, and then it describes a much slower inflation that is taking place today. And, well, he can make his potential turn over if he wants to, so that inflation will one day come to an end and the universe will re-collapse. So that's a little bit about vacuum energy, dark energy. The bottom line is we don't know, and there are all kinds of possibilities. Now, I'll say one more thing that is a little bit beyond what I was going to discuss in this course. I've introduced inflation here, and you will see more clearly on your diagrams than on the board here, there's an arrow that joins that to a point up there which corresponds to the universe becoming transparent, which we're going to see today, the microwave background. And the bottom line is that tiny temperature fluctuations that we can observe today in the microwave background eventually translate into the clustering of galaxies, hence the third blue arrow up there that
lead back more or less to this time here. It just coincides with the birth of the Sun.
The clustering of galaxies, that foam-like structure that is 300 million light-years typically in diameter, owes its origin to the tiny fluctuations in the microwave background that are considered to owe their origin to quantum fluctuations in the fabric of space-time that were frozen into the universe when it underwent inflation today. And that, if you like, is kind of one of the triumphs of modern cosmology. Certainly a triumph that will evolve the whole universe from tiny fluctuations, which we'll see in a moment, to clusters of galaxies today. Okay, well, I wasn't really going to talk about any of that, but because that's a sort of different course, but there you are. So, okay. Right, so that's the diagram you've got, and there's a bit of introduction. So today, of course, we're going to consider whether we are stardust or nuclear waste, and this is the story of the birth and death of stars. Now, when we look around the... I suppose that's inevitable that that light stays on, is it? Let's just try that. Whoa, God, that was a mistake. I knew it would be. Sorry. You'll put it all right anyway. And make it all go away. Yeah, I knew it's a big mistake to touch these things. Don't worry about it. Yeah. Oh, yes. No, we probably have to go through the whole sequence to close it all down. And that should do it. There we go. Now, maybe that light is just an inevitable part of the universe. So there you are. Good. Thanks. Like the exits. Okay. It's just I like things to look really black on the screen. Okay, when we look around at the night sky, we've been brought up to the idea that the stars and the positions of the stars and the brightness of the stars are unchanging. And of course, in a human lifetime, they are. But if we were to come back in 100,000 years' time, we would see the pattern of constellations had become quite distorted because all the stars near us in our galaxy are sweeping around the galaxy, all at slightly different speeds, so the patterns change. If we were to come back in a million years or so, we would find some stars had completely disappeared and other stars had appeared. And that is basically the fact that stars do evolve, they do change with time. Now, like all good stories, we have just now gone back to the very beginning, to 10 to the minus 44 seconds, to the Planck time, but what I want to do today is to come back to a mere 3 seconds after the start of, after the Big Bang, after the moment of creation. And just to explain, this is another graph, it's kind of pseudo-logarithmic, you'll see time along here, 3 seconds, 3 minutes, 300,000 years, 600 million years, 14,000 million years to the present day. And up this axis we have temperature. So, when the universe was 3 seconds old, the temperature was 10 to the 1,000 minutes, 10,000 million degrees. The temperature of the universe was 10,000 million degrees. And it was rapidly expanding, and it was rapidly cooling. By 3 minutes, it had dropped to a mere 1,000 million degrees. Now, out of the Big Bang, we essentially got, if you like, pure hydrogen. We got protons, we got neutrons, and we got electrons, and maybe we got this mysterious dark matter. Now, within the first 3 minutes or so, we essentially simulated what was to happen later inside stars. We started fusing hydrogen to form helium. And by the time the universe was 3 minutes old, the temperature had dropped to 1,000 million degrees, so that was now too cool, and the nuclear fusion reactions were quenched, and we were left over with a mixture of 75% hydrogen, 25% helium by mass. And from there on, during this time, more hydrogen was converted into helium than would thereafter be converted by all the stars that have been born and lived ever since. So the temperature is now too cool for those nuclear fusion reactions, but the universe continued to expand and cool. And as it did, of course, matter was drawn together by its own gravity to a very slight extent, and eventually the next stage in our tour came when the universe was about 300,000 years old, round about then, and the temperature had dropped to about 1,000 degrees. Now this was very critical, this was very important, because previous to this, the gas was full of free electrons. There were many, many photons, 10 to the 9, 1,000 million photons for every neutron or proton, and that was because of the annihilation of antimatter that had taken place a little bit earlier in the history of the universe. So loads of photons around, but they were continually being re-scattered by all the electrons. This was a plasma, a hot plasma. Now, when the temperature dropped to 1,000 degrees, the electrons could combine with the nuclei of the hydrogen and the helium, if you like, with the protons and the helium nuclei, and form neutral atoms. And at that point, the universe became transparent and the photons were able to travel in straight lines. And essentially have been doing that ever since, so that it is possible for us to see, form this image of the universe when it first became transparent. This is referred to as the microwave background image, and it is color-coded. It has an incredibly uniform temperature of about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. That's this uniformity, because this is the whole sky. So, you know, the middle bit of sky has never had time to communicate with this edge bit of sky since that moment of inflation. And what we have color-coded here are density or temperature fluctuations of one part in 100,000. So these are just color-coded to show them up. So they're incredibly small fluctuations. If I showed this really to scale, it would be completely uniform, much more uniform than the ability of the projector to project it. So here are these density fluctuations revealed as temperature fluctuations. And these density fluctuations of one part in 100,000 are responsible for all the structure, for everything that we see in the universe today. And if it wasn't for these, the universe would be completely uniform. Galaxies would have never formed. So what are these? These are slight overdensities of matter compared with the adjacent cooler region. And of course, where there are overdensities, then matter can be drawn in towards those overdensities. And that was what was going on. The universe is expanding, but matter is tending to gather together in these slightly denser regions. Now, we enter a time that astronomers rather dramatically like to refer to as the Dark Ages. You always come up with this kind of jargon. And Dark Ages is a very unscientific concept. What it means is that if you were actually floating around in the universe in your spaceship at this moment, with your eyes, you would have seen the universe get dark. It would have been a glow, you know, 1,000 degrees. It's quite kind of red hot, more like white hot. But the universe would have, the fog of the universe would have just faded away into total darkness. That's seen with your eyes. Of course, there's lots of infrared radiation around. That's because the universe is expanding, the light is being redshifted, and the wavelength stretched. So Dark Ages, nothing to be seen. And here we are entering a kind of unknown territory, because we've not been able to observe this yet. But after about 600 million years, we think the very first stars are born. That gathering together of hydrogen and helium by those overdense regions has resulted in sufficient mass to trigger collapse, the first pulling together by gravity to form the very first stars. And we have not really been able to observe those yet. So here is an artist's impression of what the universe might have looked like as the first stars burst into life. Now, these first stars were very different from stars that were to come later. And that is because they were made of pure hydrogen and helium. And for reasons to do with the way radiation is transmitted through a stellar atmosphere, it was possible for them to grow to much greater, larger masses than stars can in the present day. And it's possible
They would have then come to the end of their lives very fast and created heavy elements and things. And it's possible that those first stars created the black holes that were to form the cores of the galaxies that were to come later. But that is speculation. So we think these first stars would have created black holes. And we're very keen to see if we can find these first stars. Now, there's a possibility that we have detected a hint of the first stars, and what I'll explain this. This is the top image here. This was published in Nature in 2005. Is a very deep image of the night sky taken with an infrared satellite, an infrared telescope. And most of what you can see up here are galaxies. And I hinted yesterday when we looked at the Hubble Deep Field, there was a lot of action taking place in the infrared in the early universe, a lot of hidden star formation. And what they have done is, in this image, to subtract out all the foreground objects, and they find this rippling variation of brightness that isn't some fault of the detectors, which they think may be highly redshifted radiation from that first generation of stars. But unfortunately, there's not enough flux here to form a spectrum, because we would know what the spectrum of those very hot, bright stars would look like. And so this is certainly a challenge for new generations of telescopes. Okay, so we've seen the first stars born, and then we come through to the present. And we take up the story of the birth and death of stars in the present day. Because that is incredibly irritating, that sound up there. But never mind, I'll try and ignore it. Sorry about that. I'll speak to somebody afterwards. we come forward to the present day, and the story of essentially star birth and death was the same after that very first generation of stars, which would have come and gone very quickly, in fact, because of their very high mass. So let us come to the present day and look around the nearby universe, and we see this rather unusual coincidence of two galaxies, one in front of the other. Background, edge-on, well, tilted spiral galaxy, a bit like the Andromeda Nebula, and a foreground spiral face-on. And the interesting thing about the foreground spiral, we see the characteristic spiral arms here, but where it's silhouetted by the background galaxy, we see these lovely dark lanes, the dark lanes of dust and gas. The dust, material made by previous generations of stars, the gas, the hydrogen and helium. It is mainly gas, I should hasten to add, mainly hydrogen and helium. And so when we come to look at an image of a galaxy like this one, a bit like our own galaxy, we see these dark lanes here. We must recognize these are not the absence of material, but the presence of this dust and gas. Now, I just want to show you something, to show you the quality of the Hubble Space Telescope. It's a bit of a fun comparison. This is an image of this galaxy taken with a ground-based telescope. And if you watch carefully, I will now just do that, and you will see how we go from ground-based to space-based. I think it's always rather fun. I like these kind of before and after things. And there we are. There's with the Hubble Space Telescope, but I have to tell you, this projector is not good enough to reveal the entire quality of the Hubble telescope, so we have to just confine ourselves to a small square like this, and if I blow this small square up, then you will see the true resolution of that galaxy, which is rather impressive, because all those much appreciation. We'll just do that once more. There we are, we're going to look in that box, and there we are, there it is. Now, you can see the dark lanes. And you can also, on this image now, see regions where stars are currently being born. The red comes from hydrogen gas, bright new young born stars there, one up there, one down there. And what we would now like to do is to look at these regions of star birth in much more detail. And I can never resist the continual temptation to remind you that this white haze in here is not
caused by gas, as it is here, but it is just the unresolved background of stars. And remember, between each star, there is about 50 million stellar diameters. So this thing looks as though it's uniformly covered, but that's a problem of resolution. If the stars were all, at their real size, this would probably look black because we'd just be looking through the empty space. There'd be incredibly luminous little pinpricks of light, much smaller than pinpricks. Okay, well, we can't actually look at this in any greater detail because that's the best we can do with the Hubble. So what we have to do is come back to our own galaxy and find a similar object. And this is a star-forming region. I think it's called M16 in our own galaxy. And you'll see it has a very irregular shape. And that irregular shape is not because it is that shape, it's because it is part of what we call a giant molecular cloud, which fills up the whole of the screen here, and it is just inside the cloud we are peering through, where the cloud allows us to see through into the interior to see the region of star formation. And this is another one of those before and after images. Not really quite the same. This is done with a Schmidt telescope, and this is done with the VLT, the Very Large Telescope. So they're both ground-based images, and you will see the structure in the middle. And now you get the sense of a cavity inside a giant cloud, and you can see that there are many bright newborn stars and fainter newborn stars in this cavity, but there are also regions where the gas is still collapsing under its own gravity. What I want to do now is to focus on this region here and look at it with the Hubble Space Telescope, those sort of three fingers, if you like, and essentially that is what we see. And of course, this may be familiar to many of you because this has become sort of almost an icon of the Hubble Space Telescope. The Hubble people refer to these as pillars of creation, and I don't like that description because pillars are things that stand firmly on the ground, resisting gravity, holding up an arch. This is something quite different and unique in our experience because there's no sense of up or down. It is something drawing together, shrinking together under its own self-gravity. And that's how you must try and visualize it. In fact, I'd like you to imagine that what we are looking at here is the environment of our sun and solar system about 4,500 million years ago, when our sun was being born, because it was undoubtedly born in a very similar environment. So this gas and dust is shrinking under its own gravity. It is being partly assisted by this newborn star whose radiation pressure is exerting a force that helps this star to collapse. But it's also that radiation is having an erosive effect. It is ionizing, and you will see streamers apparently coming off the top of this thing and coming out of the side here. It's shining on the other face, so this is in dark silhouette. So, it's a combination of gravity and radiation pressure helping that collapse. And let us now just zoom in on the top part of it. And you will see these particularly dense regions that are resisting the erosive power of the nearby stars. You can see the wind blowing away from it. And these are regions where stars will soon appear. Newborn stars will appear. So you can imagine that our sun was in one of these sort of features. And you can see here these things are about solar system sized. In size.
The sound is because of a hearing enabling device, and the person who needs it is actually not here. So.
Oh, there is a gentleman here who asked me to put this on. So he's sitting up there, yes.
Okay, Frank, it's interfering terribly, so we need to deal with it.
Oh, shame. Well, look, I can put up with it myself if that...
The audience is complaining.
Oh, so I see. Oh, dear.
We'll just deal with it quickly. Sorry about this. Terrible interruption. Okay.
Oh, is that really it? Oh, I'm terribly sorry about that. Oh, no, that wasn't my mobile. Oh, dear. Sorry about this slight pause here. Would it be no? No, by hanging somewhere else. Maybe it's fine. It needs changing. Sorry.
Yeah. Overheating. Oh, it's off. Oh, it's off.
It's all sounds fine now, doesn't it? Okay. Are we ready to go? Okay, that was, I've got a few minutes injury time there, you'll notice. I might need that at the end. So, here we are, back to imagining our sun was one of these features here, one of these blobs. So, what if we were to come back in about a few hundred thousand, maybe a few tens of thousands of years' time, instead of this collapsing cloud, what we would see would be a cluster of stars. Now, I have to say straight away, for those in the know, in the audience here, this is a much more massive and much denser cluster than would appear from within the particular cloud that we've just been looking at. But nevertheless, the principles are the same. The stars would emerge, and the first thing they would do, their radiation would clear away the gas and dust around them and clear the space. And indeed, if you look carefully here, you will see here is one of those dense regions, and you see this bright shock front on the front of it, where the radiation is destroying, is ionizing gas in this collapsing cloud, and similarly up there where it's dealing with that feature. Now, you might say, if our sun was born in such a cluster, why do we not live in a cluster like that today? And some of the answer comes in this next demonstration, which is a computer model of a 1,000 solar mass cloud that is collapsing under gravity. Oh, Lord, look at that. It's not going to collapse, is it? It's collapsing under gravity, or supposed to collapse under gravity. And let me see if I can quickly get that to work. I had no end of problems, I'm afraid, with PowerPoint this morning. I suddenly had to redo the whole blessed thing. So let's see if we can very quickly, because I'd like you to see this collapsing cloud. And let's see if we can just kill it, edit, cut. And if we can't, I promise you, I'll show it to you tomorrow. Insert a movie from the table of movies. It's no end. It's very upsetting. PowerPoint movies. And here we have it. Bernal star form movie. Bernal AVI star. See if we can find it. Star, but let's just have a look here. Should be able to get it quite quickly. Choose. There we go. Automatically. File. Save. And if all goes well, this should be loop until stopped. Loop until stopped. There we go. And let's go back to View Present Tools. And let us now come down to where we are. And we should see our galaxy, our collapsing star. There we go. So, now, go on, collapse. There we go. Right, it is collapsing. Thank you. Right, this is a 1,000 solar mass cloud, about 3 light years in diameter, and it is collapsing under gravity. And the interesting thing you note about it is, it doesn't just collapse down to one spot, as would, you know, a uniform mass, because it's quite turbulent. It's like a cloud on a hot summer's day. There's a lot of sort of random motion within it. So the individual stars, as they form, take on the random motion of the gas out of which they have formed. And you can see, even though collapse is not complete, some of the stars are already being expelled from the cloud. What this does not show is that star formation is really quite inefficient, and only about a quarter of the mass does end up in stars. But and this thing is running for about 500,000 years, so that gives you the kind of time scale and gives you some idea of the sort of characteristic speed of the... We might just let that go once more. Gives you an idea of the characteristic speed of the stars on that kind of time scale. Interestingly enough, when you see this almost filament-like form that you see here, it is very reminiscent of what we see on a much, much larger scale when we see the collapse of matter to form clusters of galaxies. So the stars are moving, they give you the sense of the random motion, and some of the stars are being expelled from the cluster. So I think we can stop that there and go on. So that when you see a cluster like this, what you have to recognize is this is a seething mass of stars that are orbiting around the common center of gravity. Now, although there was enough mass to trigger the collapse of the cloud, to gravitationally bind it, in other words, by the time we have blown away three-quarters of the mass, you will recognize that there is not necessarily enough mass within this cluster to gravitationally bind the cluster. And so that the technical term is the cluster tends to evaporate, the stars disperse. And if you think the time 4,500 million years ago, since then, our sun and the stars that were born with it have orbited right around the galaxy about 20 times. So the stars that were born with us are spread out right around the circumference of the galaxy. Now, in a couple of years' time, there is a spacecraft, the Gaia spacecraft, that is going to be launched that will measure the motion and distance of not quite every star in the galaxy, but getting on that way. And we should be able to see, which will be rather fun, the stars that were simultaneously born with our sun from the way they're orbiting the galaxy. Okay, if we were to actually look for our sun amongst this cluster, we'd find it very difficult to see because it would be one of the faintest objects there. And indeed, it would be surrounded by a disk of material like this. And it's out of this disk of material we will take up the story of what happens to this disk in the next lecture when we talk about the solar system. But I just want to say something about the disk. Why is there a disk? Well, it's all to do with the conservation of angular momentum. If you think of a collapsing cloud of gas that is going to collapse on the scale of maybe a million or more in size, then it would have to be incredibly finely balanced, perfectly balanced, not to have some slight net rotation, any slight tendency for one bit to be going slightly more, you know, to be rotating, not to have cancelled out, means that by the time it's contracted, it will be spinning quite rapidly. So to form a star, we also end up with this rapidly spinning disk. And when we look at our solar system, we find that although 99% of the mass of the solar system is in the sun, something like 99% of the angular momentum is in the motion of the planets, even though the sun itself is rotating. The process of star formation is very complicated, and once again, we see something that we came across yesterday. We see this business of disks and jets. No black holes involved this time, but here is a section through the disk. There is a star in there. Planets are going to form around here, and we see evidence for this jet emerging from this object. And what I want to show you is something, again, that is really rather fun. It is evidence. If you look carefully, this bit of the movie is actually working, you will see the Hubble has been observing for something like 14 years, and from the disk here, you will see this jet moving out into space. And it's very rare in astronomy to be able to see. One rather unusual thing is a bright object is developing there, probably, I don't know, a bit of magnetic field or something, but we can see this jet moving out from this newborn star, and of course the move is just recycling. Other examples of stars that are being born, this fist here with the two jets emerging from either side and the shock front at the front there, regions where star formation is taking place. So what is a star? Well, a star is just a huge sphere of gas in what we call hydrostatic equilibrium. The process of star formation, I said, is the process of gravitational collapse of a cloud of gas. Now, the wonderful thing about the laws of physics is that the laws of physics that apply to bicycle pumps also apply to star formation. And those of you, and I'm sure many in this audience, although when I speak to school kids today, they just look at me with a sort of toe-faced blankness. I say, what happens when you pump up your bicycle tires energetically? And they all look completely blank, because I bet they never use much energy these days. But in the old days, you remember the end of the pipe gets, the pump gets hot. Well, when the star is collapsing, when the cloud is collapsing, the pressure is rising, density is rising, the temperature rises, and that pressure will resist the collapse. Now, in the early stages, of course, the temperature rises, so radiation escapes from the collapsing cloud and allows the collapse to continue. When it gets beyond a certain point, the collapse, if you like, it's a more of a runaway collapse, and indeed, the temperature is rising. And that is what brings things to a halt, because a star is this sphere of gas in perfect, what we call, hydrostatic equilibrium. So gravity is trying to squeeze the thing together, and the temperature in here maintains a pressure that resists the force of gravity, so you can draw a sphere, or a circle in this case, anywhere in the star, and there is the perfect balance, perfect equilibrium between the outward pressure and the inward force of gravity. Now, the whole story of the birth and death of stars is really the battle of matter against the force of gravity. The weakest force in the universe is the force that calls the tune and rules the day. And what happens here, we stall the force of gravity, we hold it at bay for a while, because we have nuclear fusion reactions. The temperature is now hot enough to initiate the fusion of hydrogen to form helium, and that releases energy which is able to maintain the temperature, which maintains the pressure, which holds the thing in equilibrium. Now, you probably haven't thought of the sun as an incredibly good insulator, but it is, because the temperature here is about 16 million degrees, and the temperature here is about 6,000. It takes a photon about 100,000 to maybe longer, 100,000 years to slowly scatter its way out to the surface. So it travels, if you like, 100,000 light years doing a random walk through the sun. Of course, its energy is decreasing as it collides with electrons and scattered and so on and so forth. So, once it gets to the surface, the star shines and the photons travel off in a straight line, but still at the speed of light, and 8 minutes later they pass the Earth. Now, the nuclear fusion reactions are running in the center of a star, and all stars spend most of their lives converting hydrogen into helium. But eventually, of course, we run out of hydrogen in the core. So what happens? Now, the easiest thing to see what happens is to look at stars in globular clusters. We mentioned the globular clusters around M87 yesterday. Here's a picture of a globular cluster. Two of the finest ones can be seen in the southern hemisphere. And this is one of them. I think it's 47 Tuck. And these are collections of up to almost a million stars. And unlike the sun, these stars are almost as old as the universe itself. And when we look carefully with the Hubble Space Telescope, we see two sorts of stars. You can see bright orange ones here and the much fainter white ones. Now, orange means cool, white means hot. These faint white ones are stars like the sun. These bright orange ones are what we call red giants. And this is the fate that awaits our sun, to become a red giant. And if we look closer to home in Orion, and for the southern hemisphere, I should have turned the constellation upside down, but there it is. This is, in fact, an image an actual image of a star, resolved now by the Hubble Space Telescope, of Betelgeuse in the top right corner. Now, this star, the nuclear fusion, we've run out of hydrogen in its core, so what happens? The core starts to collapse under gravity. As the pressure rises, the temperature rises, and it gets to the point where we can start fusing helium to form elements like carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. As the core contracts, the outer atmosphere of the star expands. And there is no simple way, there's no simple reason for that that I can give you. It's all to do with the way radiation is transferred from the core to the outside of the star. And if you've got a certain amount of radiation you've got to get rid of, you can either have a small, very hot thing that's very hot with a small surface area, or a much larger thing with a much larger surface area that's much cooler. And both of those, thanks to Planck's laws, will get rid of the same amount of energy. Now, so this is the fate that waits the Sun. Now, look here, size of star. See here, size of Earth's orbit. And even the diameter of Jupiter's orbit fits comfortably into the to this star. Now, the good news is the Sun will get nothing like as big as this, because the Sun will merely swallow up Mercury and Venus. The bad news, however, is that this thing is maybe 1,000, 10,000 times more luminous than the present Sun. So by the time our Sun does this, our Earth's oceans will have evaporated and the rocks will have been liquefied. But don't worry, we're only about halfway there, so there's still a few thousand million years to decide what we're going to do about that. Okay, so that may be the end of the Earth and life on Earth. I think I can confidently predict that. But it isn't quite the end of the life of the star, because it then the outer atmosphere detaches and it becomes a planetary nebula. And, as we call it, nothing to do with planets, just looked like a planet, some of them. And what we are seeing here, I'm going to show you a series of images of planetary nebulae, some of the most beautiful and unusual objects revealed by the Hubble in astronomy. Objects, spherical stars, losing their outer atmospheres. And they show this extraordinary variety of shape and form. And it is unusual, it is difficult to understand how a spherically symmetrical star can end up showing such a variety of shape and form. It's undoubtedly, as always in astronomy, when we get to a tricky patch, we invoke the presence of magnetic fields and possibly companion stars in orbit. This object and this object are the same object looked at in different wavelengths. And these concentric circles here are illuminated gas that has been lost slowly by the star during its early life. And I just want to show you rather quickly now, because we've lost a bit of time on this, some of these beautiful planetary nebulae. This particular one we've just been looking at, the Helix Nebula, is relatively close to us, so we can look at it in rather exquisite detail. And clearly the strong ultraviolet radiation from the object at the center, which is now about the size of the Earth and a temperature of about 100,000 degrees, you can see these blobs a bit like the heads of comets. And the radiation is clearly ionizing this stuff and blowing it away. Very low density, of course. Now, this particular one does have a message for us. You'll see what looks like cloud across the front of it. Cloud is a very good analogy. Really, smoke would be a better analogy, because these are particles, carbon, that has been manufactured by this star in that hydrogen and helium fusion. Carbon in nitrogen and oxygen are particles maybe a micron sized, a bit like the particles in cigarette smoke. And so when you look at this object, you are looking at one of the sorts of objects, one of many types of object actually, that has produced the carbon that is an important component not only of the wooden furniture here, but of course of our bodies. And one of the stories, if you remember nothing else from this lecture, I think one of the interesting things to remember is the following. Think of the history of the universe from start to the present day to be divided into thirds. Now, our sun and solar system have only been around for the last third of the history of the universe. So in the previous two-thirds, stars came and went and ended their lives, and as they did, they created all the elements that are here today in this room on our Earth, in our sun. All those elements, apart from the hydrogen in the water in the H2O here, that came from the Big Bang. The oxygen was made in hot stars. Everything else was made in stars. So, as the title suggests, if you are a romantic, you can consider yourself to be made of stardust. If you are less of a romantic, you are merely the nuclear waste of stellar evolution. And I'm sure there's a wonderful advertising slogan for the nuclear industry there. So there it is. That is, so you come from something like that. Okay, what happens next? Well, those planetary nebulae disperse, and we are left with things called white dwarfs. We go back to our globular cluster, look at a small area, grossly overexpose it, and we will now see the cooling white dwarfs, things about the size of the sun that are going to cool away and fade away for the rest of recorded time, and they are out of the story. Now, I have described the behavior of stars like the sun, solar mass stars. But when stars are born, they are born with a huge range of masses, and some of them much lower mass than the sun, some of them higher. And you can see higher mass stars, greater mass, greater forces of gravity, greater luminosity, the faster everything runs. And so I want to talk briefly about high mass stars. And here is an example of a star that is about 25 times the mass of the sun. And what you see here is the star losing with a huge, what we call solar wind. As it evolves, as it's burning hydrogen, it's in its hydrogen burning phase, it is blowing vast amounts of material into space. Our sun does that, as we'll see when we talk about the sun, a coronal mass ejections they're called, but the sun only gets rid of a tiny amount of its mass, whereas this star can lose up to half its mass. And here is another example of one of these very high mass stars lurking here, blowing material off into space. Now, when we have more mass, then, as I say, we can develop greater forces. So whenever we run out of one fuel and the core contracts, it heats up, we can start using that as a source of fuel for the next source of energy for our nuclear reactions. So what I want to do is to look inside the core of one of these stars. And here it is. This is a theoretical model of a 25 solar mass star. And I should just explain very briefly what these numbers down the side mean. They mean we are not modeling this in kilometers. So this is 0 kilometers and this is 10 million kilometers. We are modeling it in mass fractions. So where it says 0.6, it means 0.6 or 60% of the mass is in the outer atmosphere of the star. And that is an inert hydrogen helium atmosphere made up of the gas just as the star was formed, so unchanged from its formation. Where it says 0.1, it means 0.1 or a tenth or 10% is in this shell, and we have these what are called onion-like shells because they're one on top of the other. So as we go through the shells, we have our fusion reactions, hydrogen being converted into helium, in here helium to carbon and oxygen, carbon into neon and magnesium, and so on and so forth, till we get to the core where we are fusing silicon to form iron and nickel. And so the compositions of these shells varies inside the star. Now, if you look at the coordinates here, temperature in the core, 8,000 million degrees, and density, I have to do it, a nice audience of my contemporaries here, we won't bother with these SI units or whatever they are, it's about 9,000 grams per cubic centimeter is the density. And you will see we are building up an iron core here. And so just for fun, I thought, let's take a ship and pretend we build it out of iron with this density instead of the normal density of iron. How big, small would the ship be? Well, here we have a 91,000-ton ship to the scale model of my hand. And so it's considerably smaller than shown on the screen. So that would be how small a cruise ship would be if it was made out of iron, at the density of iron in the core of one of these stars. Of course, it would still weigh 91,000 tons, so it would go straight through the floor. I'd not be holding it. Of course, that, as any chemist will know, is an incredibly stupid analogy, because this iron here has got all its outer electrons stripped off. It's totally ionized. And, of course, it's the outer electrons that give iron the properties that make it useful for making ships out of. Okay, but we are running into a crisis here. Because we could use ever, all these elements, when they were fused, would release energy. Now, the problem with iron is it is no use as a nuclear fuel. And this is all to do with something called the binding energy, because it is the strong force that binds neutrons and protons together in the core of an atom. The strong force operates over a short distance. So to begin with, as you make ever larger nuclei, they are bound together ever more strongly. And it is that release of the potential energy of that force that gives us the and nuclear fusion energy. But beyond a certain point, and iron is that point, the nuclei are getting bigger and bigger, but they're held together more and more weakly. So we cannot derive energy by creating them. In fact, you will know this from your history, because you will know the first nuclear weapons were called atomic bombs. They took plutonium and uranium, and they split the atom to release the energy. But then the next generation simulated what happens in stars. We took deuterium and tritium and fused it and released energy. So there's a crisis point around iron where you cannot split nor fuse to make energy. But gravity does not care about that. So what happens next? So here we have a core with all these nuclear fusion reactions going on I've just been talking about, and we build up this iron core, and there is no longer a source of energy there. So what happens is gravity takes over, compresses the iron core, raises the temperature to the point where the photons are now so energetic that they dissociate the iron core. The iron core then is dissociated, and in a sense, in a tenth of a second, we reverse the entire history of nuclear fusion reactions, and we revert to alpha particles and neutrons, and we have protons and electrons combining to form more neutrons, and we start to create a neutron star at the core of this star, a neutron core, if you like, at the core of this enormous star. Now, the neutron star is much smaller. It's only about 20 kilometers or so in diameter compared with something the size of the Earth. So the outer layers of the star start to collapse, start to fall inwards. Now, I showed you the analogy of the iron in our cruise ship. Now I want to show you an analogy for the density of a neutron star, and we need a slightly different model this time. If we took Table Mountain and compressed it to the density of neutron star material, that would be the size. And this, interestingly, is just another way of saying that the atoms of the room and the universe are essentially all empty space. It is only the outer electrons that make my knuckles sore when I do this. It's nothing to do with the nuclei. So compress Table Mountain to nuclear material, this is the density it would have. And that is typically the density of a neutron star. Now, I did a little sum with this because, of course, this thing now has its own gravity. And we can now start to measure gravity seriously when we compress the whole Table Mountain into this side. Remember, that's a kilometer from top to bottom there. And the force of Table Mountain closing my hand, my fingers would be squeezed around it with a force on them of about 22 kilograms. So I would not be able to probably open my hand. It would be around Table Mountain. But nevertheless, I don't know what the density of that is. It's 100 million tons per cubic centimeter, so I would certainly not be holding on to it, but there you are. Okay, that's neutron star density. So what happens? The outer layers of the star collapse, they bounce on this rigid neutron star, and a shock wave forms and starts to propagate outwards through the infalling material. Now, symbolically, this is all shown beautifully, spherically symmetrical, but the actual models that are made show a sort of huge amount of turbulence and mixing and so on and so forth. Now, as that shock wave propagates out through the surface, at very, very high densities and temperatures are reached. There are lots of free neutrons, and what happens is we get neutron fusion, neutron capture onto heavy elements, onto the nickel elements close to iron in the periodic table, and we build up by neutron capture, the neutrons then decay into protons. We build up all the rest of the heavy elements in the periodic table of elements during this time as this shock wave propagates out. And the shock wave eventually bursts through the surface of the star and we have a supernova. This is what happens to one of these more massive stars. Now, what I was implicit in that reaction, reaction I showed was that an enormous amount of neutrinos are released during this collapse of the iron, this conversion of iron to alpha particles. And so when we look at the energetics, and this is of a particular explosion that took place, we find that 99% of the energy of the explosion comes out in neutrinos and streams out into space. And indeed, one of the problems of modelling, trying to understand these supernova explosions, is neutrinos will go through a light year of lead before you stop them dead, but you have to take some of the neutrino energy to ensure that the shock wave propagates out through the exploding star. Otherwise, it just stalls and the whole lot collapses. So, you know, it's very difficult to do that. So 99% of neutrinos, 1% of, that's the remainder, 99% of that 1% is the kinetic energy of expanding debris. So only 1% of 1% comes out as light that then can outshine an entire galaxy. And this was really the, as we're going to mention, a particular supernova 1987A, but that sort of argument is general for supernovas. And in fact, with this particular supernova, the one that I'm about to mention that took place in the Magellanic Cloud almost 25 years ago, those neutrinos, about 10 of those neutrinos, were detected by a detector in Japan after they'd already passed through the Earth, because the Japanese detector was on the other side of the Earth. But there is a supernova outshining its galaxy. Now, I want to take you back 25 years to 23rd of February 1987, and here we are in our own galaxy, and over here is the satellite galaxy, the Large Magellanic Cloud, about 160,000 light years away. A small, maybe 1% the mass of our own galaxy, a little satellite galaxy. Very important. A lot of work in South Africa has been done on this particular object. Here it is, the Large Magellanic Cloud. Very useful for calibrating distances and properties of stars, because you can treat all the stars in this thing as at the same distance. So we're going to zoom in. It's got star-forming regions here. Zoom in on that, and we look at this little blob here. And on the night of the 23rd of February 1987, the star in the middle, there are three stars there actually, came to the end of its life. The shock wave broke through the surface, and in a matter of hours, this star was easily outshining the whole of this little galaxy. And the size here is all to do with the fact it was fogging the photographic plate, nothing to do with the fact that it's an expanding piece of debris. Now, one of the predictions that we made, I told you about how all these neutrons were being captured and making elements right up the rest of the periodic table of elements, and this was predicted by the theoreticians, and one of those was that silicon and sulfur would combine to form nickel-56, which is highly radioactive, that would decay to form cobalt-56. With a half-life of about 61 days, and cobalt-56 is highly radioactive, and decays to iron 56, and it emits neutrinos and gamma rays with the 77-day half-life. And what we were able to do, and this was work done at the South African Astronomical Observatory, was to observe the light curve of the supernova. Now, you might imagine, when a star explodes, it's like a firework or a hand grenade. Bang, big flash, and then it fades away. And indeed, you see the big flash at the top there, and then it fades away. But it doesn't just fade right down to zero again. It faded away very, very at a very steady rate, at a linear rate in this log linear diagram, which means that it is an exponential decay, and the exponential decay rate exactly fitted the exponential decay rate of cobalt 56. And what kept it bright were the gamma rays from that radioactive decay. So we could demonstrate that indeed this radioactive element had been created during the explosion. Well, this was before the age of the Hubble. 9 years later, Hubble came along, looked at the three stars, and we could see this lovely little ring in the center. The star itself had disappeared, but there was a luminous ring. In fact, gas that had been lost by the star before it exploded that was fluorescing under the enormous radiation from that explosion. And indeed, today, we are still observing this ring. As the debris from the explosion finally reaches it, traveling at maybe 10, 12,000 kilometers per second, it's colliding with the gas, causing it to glow in the X-ray, and will blow it all away. So what happens next? Well, in order to see what happens next, we have to go back in time to the year 1054, when the Chinese saw a supernova explode in our own galaxy and recorded its position accurately enough for us to detect it today. And here is the result of that explosion nearly 2,000 years later. We see expanding debris from the explosion mixing with interstellar material, expanding out into space. And inside the box there lurks a spinning neutron star. We have not, and that is the neutron star that was left over. We have not yet detected the neutron star in supernova 1987A. And, oh crikey, yes, I have got a couple of minutes of injury time. I want to really finish this off today. So there it is. A few thousand years later, the stuff expands into space. Now, I want to say something very briefly about the most massive stars. Fortunately, very rare. Lurking in here, in Carina, in the southern hemisphere, is a star that is 100 times the mass. There it is, 100 times the mass of the Sun. That means it's not 100 times as bright, it is 1,000,000 times as bright. And that means its life will be very short, and it's very unstable. What you see here are a puff of gas from a surface explosion that took place, observed by Herschel, in about 1826. We have only recently come to realize how potentially dangerous an object like that is. And the story here briefly goes back to 1962, when there was a nuclear test ban treaty and the Americans launched a series of satellites to monitor the Earth and surrounding space for illicit detonation of nuclear weapons. A nuclear weapon gives a double flash, a flash of gamma rays. So they were looking for flashes of gamma rays. From about 63 to 69, they detected sources uniformly spread across the sky. There was one possible exception of a possible flash in the South Atlantic, which was never fully explained, but all the rest were in space. In 1971, they released this map showing where the gamma ray bursts had taken place. Nobody knew what these bursts were. Nobody predicted that gamma rays would come from any source in astronomy. They don't show the structure of the Milky Way. They are uniform. That means they're either very close or very far away. And because if they were just normal stars, we'd see the pattern of the Milky Way galaxy. It was not till 1998 or so that we had a satellite that could observe gamma rays and X-rays simultaneously. We can define their directions accurately enough to send the recording down to the ground to point the Hubble Space Telescope to discover the gamma ray burst was coming from cosmological distances, in this case about 4,000 million light years away. And then it was recognized that these are indeed some of the most powerful objects in the universe. And in fact, one went off in 2008 that was at a distance of 7,000 million light years, and it was bright enough to be seen with the naked eye. Now, if it had been at the distance of Eta Carina, it would have outshone the sun in the sky. What is happening here is these massive stars are collapsing under gravity. They're not forming neutron stars, they are forming black holes. The black holes form accretion disks, the accretion disks form jets that punch their way out through the collapsing star and launch a highly collimated, in other words, a very narrow beam of gamma rays into space. If those gamma rays are pointing in our direction, then we will see a very bright gamma ray burst in the sky. Now, if we do all the probabilities and calculations, we'll see that our Earth is probably exposed to a gamma ray burst about once every a million years, which is longer than the age of the universe. So we don't have to worry. And the axis of Eta Carina does not seem to be pointing towards us. Okay, stars fill the universe, fill the galaxy with stuff, blow it out, it then collapses to form new stars, and you've got this diagram, and you can see on this diagram a wonderful sort of flow diagram, starting with the Big Bang, the first clouds collapsing to form stars, massive stars going around this way, lower mass stars going around this way. Both, this lot goes fast, producing heavy elements. This lot runs more slowly, but far more go around this way, and they recycle material like an ecological system, except it's not perfect because stuff falls out. Planets, once they're out of the system, they're out of it. Some stars are of such low mass, they never do anything. The white dwarfs are out of it because the galaxy is so large, they never get swallowed up or collide. So they're out of the cycle. The neutron stars and the black holes are out of it. So the process of stellar evolution, the birth and death of stars, eventually comes to an end. And if you look on that other grand diagram, you will see on the logarithmic scale a little arrow that says all stars dead. Okay, I'm sorry to have rushed it a bit. 5 minutes over time. Maybe we can have questions. Either you can come and ask me now, or maybe tomorrow morning we'll have a few questions. Thank you very much. We're allowed 5 minutes of questions. I've just been told by my boss up there. So has anybody got any questions they'd like to ask? Yes.
Why are 1A type 1A supernova good signals of distance? Well, what I've described is a type 2 supernova. A type 1A supernova is actually quite different. It's in a binary system. It's a white dwarf that sits there, suddenly gets a load more mass put on it, which pushes it over what's called the Chandrasekhar limit, and in a fraction of a second, nuclear fusion reactions burn all the way up to iron, and nothing is left. The whole thing blows out into space and leaves no cinder behind. Also produces a lot of heavy elements. Why are they good standard candles? Because they tend to always have the same mass, so they make the same luminosity. But having said that, they are lots of complications. There's something like a factor of two in luminosity, because when they explode, the core ignites off-center, and so it tends to blow out one way faster than the other. So the orientation alters the way we see them, but we have a way of correcting for that. That's type 1A supernova. Yes?
This matter you're covering in your course, is it also covered in the book you recommend?
Martin Rees. I think Martin Rees, my great hero, I think he covers everything. Yes, he does. He will talk about the stellar evolution. In fact, my proudest moment in my research life was that Martin Rees looked at this diagram, liked it so much, he adapted it for one of his books. So he did the job.
Referring to the magnetic surface supernova,
Good question. Did the neutrinos arrive before or after?
We could not distinguish the neutrinos from the light. So you could say after 160,000 years, the neutrinos and the light arrived simultaneously. And you may say, so how can neutrinos travel faster than light if they're only going a short distance across northern Italy and travel at not faster than light when they've come all this distance? Well, at the time all this came out, all of us thought that is obvious answer. This neutrino observation is nonsense. They can't travel faster than light. But the people who published the paper weren't that ill-informed. They knew about 1987, and I looked in the literature, and there are indeed some quantum gravity calculations that are far beyond me, where somebody had suggested, well, there could be some energy term. The neutrinos here are lower energy neutrinos than the neutrinos that came out of the Grand Sasso experiment. So they're not necessarily contradictory, but it does put quite a strong boundary on any theory that describes neutrinos going faster than light.
Now, what's the
question?
Why couldn't neutrinos not be in the missing energy?
In fact, I show neutrinos do have a mass, and there is a heck of a lot of them around. We have some idea of the mass, and in the diagram I showed yesterday in the pie chart, it did actually have neutrinos, and they are only thought to make up a very tiny proportion of the missing mass. So they come in with the baryonic mass, with our sort of mass, but they only make up a small amount. So we don't think the masses of the neutrinos can explain dark matter. Yeah, that's the answer. Yeah. Any other questions? Otherwise.
Could we have a copy of this diagram?
You have a copy of this diagram. Oh, yes. There you are.